court or whether they reject that, and then it goes back and that criminal case can continue. There's the civil case for civil fraud in New York City, which has already been decided against him. But they've been running an ongoing trial to determine what the penalties should be, which from the articles I've read could be from anywhere from $250 to $380 million, which is a lot of money.
Which is a lot of money.
And then there's a prosecution at the state level in South Carolina about his meddling, his election meddling down there, where he was trying to encourage state election officials to find him 11,000 votes to overturn the vote in that state at the last presidential election. So lots of trouble on his front. But the one thing that doesn't seem to happen is there never seem to be any actual consequences for him yet. I mean, there's all these judgments, right? They're a lot of money. But is he going to pay for those things?
While he was born rich, he had this illusion that he was a self-made man. And they said if he put what his father gave him in Standard & Poor's, he would have a lot more money.
If he just invested it.
Yeah, so he had a snake and ladders career up and down. No, I'd like to bring something up. One of the issues is, starting in 2007, mm-hmm. and prior to COVID, did the Donald Trump administration help the economy? Like, was there a good economy because of the administration? Now, the reason I say administration as opposed to Donald Trump is that I see if there was some economic benefit from the presidency, it was probably from the people he had around him that created the situation, because it's sort of said that Roger Stone was the one who created the presidency. Like, he had the idea. He said over the years, well, you would make a good president, but you won't be elected. So his thing with Trump, which he was successful in 2006.
There 2016.
Were, 2016. Yeah. That's right. Anyway, so I think there were people who Stone knew, and, well, Donald Trump knew, that were part of certain committees and so on that he had to appoint. So that's a good question. Was he good? Did he do an economic resurgence or not? The other thing is that we're dealing with a bit different thing now is inflation, because we didn't have inflation like we got now. So would a Trump presidency be as helpful to the economy as it was in 2007? The other
17.
Thing is 17. Okay. Another technical error. The other thing is that you also have him doing the border thing. There was a point where federal employees weren't being paid because of the border wall. Remember that,
Meg? Well, they do get every now and again they have these budget standoffs because they have to pass a resolution in Congress to enable the federal government to borrow more money because they run a bit of a deficit. So the debt goes up, right, sort of on an ongoing basis for various reasons, and they have to authorize that debt ceiling to go up. And if they don't, then they can't spend any money, because any spending money would make it go up. And that sort of grinds the whole government to a halt for a period of time, except for essential services.
No, but he did that thing because he was so intent on the wall that he said, oh, well, we're not going to pay the federal employees. And they weren't paid for about a few months, right? Remember?
I don't remember that exactly.
My point is that you get all these negative things you wouldn't have with anybody else but him.
Yeah.
And so I'm saying there could be – if you look at the first term, mm-hmm. You could have said, yes, the administration did have an economic resurgence. But he also caused problems, and we're going to get more of that. And he may not be able to control the inflation if he gets elected.
Well, one thing that's happening right now is that the Democrats and the Republicans have put together a sort of bipartisan program to deal with immigration issues and the border, right?
Right.
But Trump, because he doesn't want that, he doesn't want the problem to be solved or solutions to be put forth, because he wants the situation at the border to stay bad because he can milk it as a political issue and blame it on Biden. And so even though the two parties came together with a solution, he argued against it, and a certain amount of Republican congressmen and senators, you know, followed his lead to prevent that bill from being passed, which is to say preventing any action being taken.
Which is a bit convoluted, because he's actually for it being passed. He doesn't want to have it passed because he wants to have it that but the Democrats look bad.
Yeah, he, you know, if it gets passed now, it looks good for Biden, and he wants things to stay bad until he gets in.
But he actually wants it. If he were in office, he would want that passed. So that is a bit Machiavellian.
Yeah.
The other thing about the wall seems kind of dumb, because he's always talked about a physical wall. When you would, if you were really to have something like that, you would have like a wall where you would have surveillance, or you would have like an electronic wall or something like this. I mean, he insists upon this physical wall, which is not, I mean, I don't think it can be built.
No.
And the other thing was
not in a way that it couldn't be defeated by people who are determined.
The other thing was that he was saying, well, the Mexicans should pay for the wall. And someone said, well, all what happens is the United States won't be giving Mexico that much money. They would, because the United States supposedly gives Mexico a certain amount of money, so it would be a subtraction. Oh,
right.
you don't get as much now.
I don't know.
I mean, that was sort of, as I said, he was born rich, and he got
rich and entitled.
Well, no, it was just that, as I said, it was Roger Stone's idea that he could win the presidency and hang on certain concepts that he would be more attuned to than other people would.
And for all his trouble, I think Roger Stone ended up in jail.
No, he didn't.
Didn't he?
He didn't wind up in jail because the legality was Trump could not pardon him. He had to do something else.
Yeah.
And something like that. I mean, look at Hillary Clinton, 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I said about Haiti a few weeks back that in 2009, as Secretary of State, she was against the minimum wage in Haiti going from 25 cents to 60 cents. So there you go. That's the kind of person Hillary Clinton is, the opponent.
Yeah. All right. Well, George, Donald Trump had lots of legal troubles. One of the issues in the federal case and the decision about whether he can he's immune from being charged with any crimes when he was president is that it has the potential to delay that criminal trial for his role in the January 6th insurrection until after the election, because if the court decides to take it on, that can take a whole bunch of time to play out. And meanwhile, the criminal trial is on hold. So we'll see how that all plays out, because one of the concerns of people who are concerned about it is that if it doesn't complete itself before the election, once Donald Trump gets elected, then he can just order the Department of Justice to cancel the whole thing, even though it's against him, and nothing happens with it.
Yeah, I guess so.
Anyway, lots of crazy stuff.
Well, what about Joe Biden and his son? I mean, he contended there wasn't anything to any of the contentions, and now it winds up that it seems that there are. So there you go.
True, but I guess one big difference is that, you know, they were relatively minor things, but also the fact that his son was never a government employee or, you know, in an official position.
There's
And they weren't, you know, it's the son, not Joe Biden, who's being...
Well,
so while it looks bad, I don't think it really compares. Yeah,
well, as far as the he had employment in the Ukraine,
yeah.
That they say the reason his son got the employment was because he was vice president at the time, and mm-hmm. this was a kind of a way to get to the vice presidency and presidency.
All right.
Well, there's still. Trouble on both sides of the fence.
Yep.
Magnus.
Okay. Well, we're out of time for this discussion. We'll take it back up again another time. This is a radio documentary produced here at CJSF all about Guatemala. Hope you enjoy.
Guatemala. A Central American country that borders Mexico was most recently in the news for finding a former president guilty of genocide.
By unanimous decision, the court declares that the accused José Efraín Ríos Montt is responsible as the author of the crime of genocide.
Even though the trial was restarted on a technicality, this is all part of the country's effort to overcome the effects of a devastating civil war that lasted 30 years. The conflict, which started in the 50s, was fought between leftist guerrillas and the army. The UN estimates that 25,000 people died, but other organizations say it could be as high as 40,000.
During a 36-year civil war, 45,000 students, political activists, and peasants were disappeared, and 200,000 Mayan Indians were killed in the countryside.
Nati Garcia is the daughter of a Guatemalan couple who fled the war. They arrived in Vancouver when she was 3 years old. Now 30, Nati is 5'5", dark-skinned, she's got brown eyes and a quick smile. Despite arriving at a very young age, Nati usually wears traditional Mayan clothing and identifies with the culture her family left behind. Nati's parents are Mayan, a group of indigenous people who live in Central America and parts of Mexico. They were heavily targeted by the military during the war. Like thousands of other Guatemalan refugees, Nati's family was forced to flee when their hometown became a battleground. According to Nati, when they arrived in Vancouver in the late 1980s, they didn't have many things to call their own.
We lived in a one or two bedroom place, our first home, and it was about five of us. So we all shared this one mattress. So there was a lot of tension sometimes, and people wanted their own space, but didn't get that. But we'd all have to sleep on one mattress. And I remember that. And everything was very old in the household. Everything was secondhand. It was gifted. It was from donations. And I remember our clothes never really fit us well enough.
Vancouver is nothing like the place her parents grew up in. Her family is from a region called Ixcan in the Guatemalan jungle. Even though her family didn't have many material possessions, Fabiana Morales, Nati's mom, has fond memories of the village she grew up in. Given its climate and location, it was a perfect place to grow crops. So despite being a poor area, Fabiana says they were never hungry. Violence spilled into Ixcan when Fabiana was 18 years old. The leftist guerrilla had been operating in the region for a while, but the real problem started when the discovery of natural resources got the army interested in occupying those lands. The army was brutal in its mission to control Ixcan. They used the scorched earth strategy, destroying everything in their path and killing everyone who they considered a threat to their control over the region. Fabiana, who only speaks Spanish and Mayan mom, told us about when the army made its way into her village.
The next day we saw it with our own eyes. We saw smoke. They were already burning the houses. They were burning everything in their way. So we left.
Fabiana and her family fled to the mountains. The lush vegetation provided many hiding spots, but the army was tirelessly tracking them down.
Entonces ellos se dieron cuenta que si hay gente todavía viviendo.
The army realized that some people were still alive. They started shooting everything that moved. We heard the shots being fired, and that was the day we decided we couldn't hide there anymore.
Ya no podríamos estar ahí en ese lugar.
Ill-equipped for the journey through the treacherous Guatemalan jungle, some decided to stay behind.
My father said, "You go. I will stay here to die because I don't have little ones." So he stayed. He said, "I'm going to find a little corner here in the mountain." My parents lived on that mountain for 12 years.
Fabiana and her family spent 8 years as refugees in Mexico. When they arrived in Canada, other Guatemalan refugees became the only connection to the land they had left behind. Before we continue, we want to warn listeners that the next section contains a testimony that some people could find disturbing.
When I was 8 and 9 years old, we went to a friend's place in Surrey. We were really good friends with them at that time. My parents were good friends with them at that time. It was a celebration, a party. So we went to this person's place to be in that space again. And we had ended up staying that night at that friend's place because my parents weren't sober enough to go back home. And all the kids that were there with her had ended up being put in a room where we'd sleep all together. And we'd slept there a few times in the past. But this one night in particular, when I was really young, there was this one person that came in to that room when I was asleep. And I remember waking up feeling that it was a dream and it was really dark. And this young person had kind of woken me up by pressing his arms onto my body. And I remember opening my eyes and seeing this person looking at me. And I remember having this feeling of fear, this feeling of pain, this feeling of what is happening. And then this person had ended up doing these sexual kind of actions that I wasn't familiar with at that age. And I actually ended up closing my eyes really tightly and hoping that it would go away, and then ended up waking up my eyes, opening my eyes again, and it was daylight, and all the kids were awake. Somebody was making breakfast downstairs in the kitchen, and I remember thinking to myself that maybe it was a bad dream, maybe it was something that I always felt that it was a bad dream.
Even though the experience had left her deeply disturbed, Nati decided not to tell anyone what had happened to her.
I didn't tell anybody because I felt I didn't understand it. I wasn't sure. I would never had that conversation with my parents about respecting your body, about if you ever feel anyone that does any harm to you in any way, or if you feel scared in any way in a moment, to let us know. I hadn't had those conversations with my parents or had built that trust enough with my parents.
That wasn't the only topic they didn't discuss, though. Nati's parents had never told their children about the hardships they faced during their exile. Nati's questions were always met with evasives or silence. When Fabiana arrived in Canada, the country felt like a totally foreign place to her. She didn't know anyone, so she stayed home a lot. Unable to grow her own food, Fabiana felt she couldn't connect to this new land. And without any professional help, she and her husband were having issues coping with their past.
Antes, él estuvo, tenía mucho problema.
My husband used to have a lot of problems. He was maybe 20 or 25 years old when the war started, and that kind of affected him. He used to feel a little bit of rage, and that made him start drinking. Sometimes at the house he would be drunk, and all that rage he had, he would take it out on us. He would take it out on the family. Sometimes he would hurt the family. So the children started being afraid of him.
My parents' relationship was, I feel, was full of a lot of tensions. I remember listening and witnessing to some of the arguments that they would have and not understanding where it came from, but only feeling the emotions that came from it.
All the tension, sadness, and silence drew Nati away from home. Feeling disconnected to her own family, she befriended other teenagers from troubled homes. At age 12, she became sexually active, and then she started drinking and doing drugs. Her parents didn't know what she was up to. She barely spoke to them.
My relationship with my parents during my childhood was, there was a lot of anger. I did not communicate with them at all about anything. I hated them. Like, I just, especially my dad, I hated my dad. I felt that he had brought all of this pain to me. I felt it was because of his alcoholism. It was because of the violence that he brought into the household that it drove me to where I was as a teenager. And my mom, I hated my mom because I felt that she wasn't there for me.
Nati still hadn't come to terms with what had happened to her as a child. She frequently had a disturbing dream about a shadow sexually forcing itself into her. But she hadn't considered the possibility that the dreams were based on reality. Everything changed one day when she ran into a familiar figure while picking blueberries with her mom.
I remember in a far distance seeing this figure of a man talking to my mom, and I guess talking to the other family members there. And I remember just this feeling of fear just entering my body. I just became paralyzed. That paralyzation, similar to what had happened during that incident, I felt that again. And I was triggered by this figure and did not know what it was. And it wasn't until later, and I had like run into like the blueberry bushes, and I had just hid there. I just stayed there. I didn't want to come out. And not until later on in the evening when that person had left and we had gone back home, I started to ponder on that question as to why I had felt that way. And I came to realize that this feeling really was connected to the dream that I had. And I didn't know fully then, but it was a start into opening that wound of understanding that this was not a dream. What had happened was real.
After realizing that she had been a victim of sexual assault, she confided it to her best friend, who encouraged her to deal with it. It was the first time Nati said what had happened to her out loud.
I cried a lot. It was the first time I had cried in front of anybody, and it was with her because I trusted her. She was the first person I really, really trusted, so she held that space for me to share my childhood.
Finally, being able to talk to someone about the experience proved helpful. But Nati still hadn't dealt with many of the underlying issues. She spent the next 10 years taking refuge in alcohol, drugs, and destructive relationships. By then, her parents had found a way to sober up by reconnecting with their indigenous roots. But Nati was convinced this strategy wouldn't work for her. Looking for a fresh start, she and her best friend moved to Montreal. But the new setting didn't change Nati's old habits. She continued to abuse drugs and alcohol. Her behavior eventually led to a fight with her friend. The fallout made Nati realize she had to fully confront what had happened to her as a child. So she went back home to tell her parents about it.
That conversation was very hard. It was one of the most challenging conversations I have had with my family. I remember all of us sitting kind of like a circle, and I remember nobody had any idea why they were there, why this was being initiated by me. I told them that I hadn't told them because I didn't trust them. I didn't feel they would understand, or it was more of trust. I just didn't trust them, and I told them that. I had still hated them and had resentment towards them, so it was hard for me to share anything with them. So this was one of the first moments where I really shared something vulnerable to my parents.
Listening to Nati, Fabiana realized that keeping her children in the dark had created trust issues, so she decided to open up to them. After walking in the jungle for 8 days, Fabiana and her family finally made it to Mexico. But they soon realized they weren't alone. Thousands of people had fled to the neighboring country, where a makeshift refugee camp had been established near the border.
The United Nations had already arrived to help, but since we were thousands of people, we only got one or two tortillas a day. And that's not enough for a person. It's not enough to sustain a body. We didn't have any clothes. We didn't have cooking utensils. We had nothing. We went out looking for scraps, for anything we could use to boil some water. And that's when people started getting sick. One of my children died because he was struck by sickness.
The family was then sent to another refugee camp in the Mexican state of Campeche. They lived there for the next 8 years. It was here where Nati was born. The conditions were similar to the ones they had faced in the border.
The place they sent us to was dry. The water, well, they would only give us a liter per person per day. And that's not enough. The food was the same, it was rationed. So I would give my children all of it. Even if I didn't eat anything.
Slowly, Fabiana lost hope. She started thinking that the family would have to stay in Campeche forever. But one day, out of the blue, they received a letter from Fabiana's brother-in-law. He had emigrated to Canada before the family fled to Mexico. He initially thought they had died during the conflict, but after discovering his family members were alive, he helped them resettle in Vancouver. It was then that Fabiana and her husband decided they would never discuss the details of their exile with their children.
I think that if my parents had been a bit more open to their own experience, it would have been a more safer space for me to be able to share my experience, because I would have known that, wow, you've gone through so much. You can relate to my pain.
Nati's confession motivated her parents to finally share their experiences during the war. Understanding all the violence and trauma they endured for almost a decade has allowed her to put away her negative feelings towards them. She now embraces them for who they are. But Nati's commitment to break the silence goes well beyond her household. Now she's a social worker.
I'm very focused with youth and children because I realize the importance of the innocence, the importance of providing that nurturing space and empowering them as beautiful beings to see their true power and allow themselves to creatively explore it and connect with it.
Nati's family is still healing, but coping with decades of silence takes time and the help of every family member. Nati's parents don't drink anymore. The family has also found a place where they can grow traditional Guatemalan crops. Joining her parents at the farm has helped Nati reconnect with her indigenous roots. All of this makes Nati have high hopes for the future.
I'm still healing, so I see myself being a bit more liberated and free and working with a community, my community back home in Guatemala. And I see my family full of lots of love and joy, and I see them stronger. I see the roots of our household to be more grounded.
This documentary was produced by Carlos Tello and Aurora Tejeda with the support and assistance of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. We would like to thank Nati and Fabiana for sharing their stories with us.
Thanks for tuning in. This has been Speak Up for Tuesday. Hope you enjoyed the program. We started off with a discussion about the World Bank. Also had a bit of discussion about our man in Washington, Donald Trump, and his many legal problems that don't seem to preventing him from being one of the, from perhaps winning the presidency in the fall, which is a bit scary. And then thanks for that documentary as part of our Making Time for Radio documentary series, Aurora Tragedia, was the documentary producer.